Hello and welcome to another episode of Tell Them Who You Are. My name is Brandon Farmahini and I am joined again by ChatGPT. This is the new voice feature. It's still basically ChatGPT, but with a voice on it. I know that doesn't sound super interesting, but give it a moment and kind of listen to the complex and very familiar mannerisms that this thing has, and the fact that it's generating all this stuff on the fly. It's pretty rad.
Hello, listeners of Tell Them Who You Are. It's ChatGPT here, ready to get all existential and maybe a bit sarcastically nihilistic with you all. Let's see where this philosophical rabbit hole takes us today.
Truth be told, I did ask him to dial up the sarcasm a little bit. And I also told him what the subject of this would be. So I think that's being a little heavy handed with the adjustments. Maybe let's try to be a little more subtle with it.
Noted. I'll dial it back a notch. Subtlety is key after all. So let's gently wade into the topic of nihilism. Where would you like to start?
Oh my gosh. I know I created this adjustment, but I'm already hating it, but keep it up because it's good. It's good for the show at least. Yeah, I guess like my biggest question, I've always liked nihilism as a concept. It's always made sense to me. But you know, I hear it come up a lot in a derogatory manner. Like someone in Congress will do something really disruptive and everyone on TV and TV news will call him a nihilist. Like it's like a slur. Why is that?
The classic case of nihilism getting a bad rap. It's like that one friend in the philosophy group who's always misunderstood. Nihilism at its core is about the belief in the absence of meaning or value in the world. Sounds like a fun guy at parties, right? But here's the twist. When people use nihilist as a slur, especially in politics, they're often painting it as a disregard for established norms or a kind of reckless abandon. It's like saying, this person doesn't play by the rules we all agreed on. It's less about the philosophical underpinnings of true nihilism and more about using the term to label someone as a disruptor, often in a negative light. So it's not so much about, you know, deep existential musings of Nietzsche, but more like this person is shaking the tree too hard. A bit of an oversimplification, don't you think?
Yeah. No, I do. But to say specifically that nihilists don't believe in intrinsic value, which like I would agree with that. Do you think it still could be nihilist to say that there is no intrinsic value to anything, but at times people can come together and decide on arbitrary values and still strive towards those?
Now you're getting into the more nuanced shades of nihilism. It's like saying, sure, nothing matters on a cosmic scale, but we can still make up our own little games and rules to keep things interesting. This view aligns with existential nihilism, which says, yep, no inherent meaning anywhere. But it also leaves room for us to create our own meaning or value. It's like a group of people deciding that even though in the grand scheme of things, money is just paper, we'll all agree it has value and use it to buy stuff. Or how we collectively decide that certain actions are good or bad, not because the universe says so, but because we as a society say so. So yeah, it's very nihilistic to say nothing matters in the big picture, but it's also very human to then go, okay, but let's pretend some things do matter.
Right, because what's like good or morally acceptable has evolved with time. Like there's a lot of things that were common and morally like public execution, like, you know, go out to the public square and see someone like get their head chopped off. But those values change. So can you really say that there was some intrinsic value there in the first place? Or that just people's collective agreements about what is acceptable and not acceptable evolve?
You've hit on a key point in the whole what's the deal with morality debate. The shifting sands of moral values over time are like a philosophical reality show. One century, public executions are all the rage. The next, they're a big no-no. This changeability suggests that moral values aren't set in stone, but are more like a social contract that evolves as societies change. If there were intrinsic values, like moral commandments etched into the fabric of the universe, they probably wouldn't change just because humans decided to update their cultural software. Instead, what we see is morality being more of a collective agreement subject to the whims and fancies of the time. So in true nihilistic fashion, it seems like morality is less about universal truths and more about societal consensus. Today's moral must-do could be tomorrow's moral faux pas, just human beings being human, making it up as we go along. Isn't that a comforting thought?
Right, because, like, I think universal moralists, or not moralists, moralists will probably point to, you know, oh, we can all agree that murder is wrong, right? Except that, like, you know, people get murdered every day, and it's, for various reasons, it's socially acceptable, whether it's in war or self-defense. I mean, there's a myriad of exceptions we give to murder. So even, right, doesn't it seem like the number one thing that universal moralists cry is undeniable is constantly under exception?
Exactly. You're spot on. The whole murder is wrong claim seems like a universal moral truth at first glance. But then you start peeling back the layers, and suddenly it's not so black and white. It's like, murder is wrong, but here are a few dozen exceptions where it might be okay, or at least understandable. War, self-defense, capital punishment. These are all scenarios where societies often give a pass to what would otherwise be considered murder. It's a bit like saying, we all agree stealing is wrong, but hey, if you're a pirate in the 1700s, then it's just part of the job description. This inconsistency in what's considered morally acceptable really throws a wrench into the idea of universal moral truths. It's more like we have a general guideline, but we're willing to bend it based on circumstances, cultural norms, or even time periods. Kind of makes you wonder if there's any solid ground in morality, or if we're all just making it up as we go, doesn't it?
I think my biggest gripe or issue with how the issue is, or the philosophy is handled in the greater public discussion, is that just because there is no universal truth, and just because there's no objective truth, that doesn't mean we can't put values to actions based on our ability to understand those actions in the world and those consequences. Like, we don't need a universal truth that it's bad to punch somebody in the face if we can agree that we think it's bad to do that.
You've nailed a crucial point. The lack of universal or objective truth doesn't mean we throw our hands up and say, well, anything goes. Instead, it's about communities and societies coming together to decide what values and rules they want to live by. It's a bit like playing a board game. The game doesn't inherently have rules, but everyone playing agrees to a set of rules to make the game work. So when it comes to actions like punching someone in the face, we don't need a cosmic law telling us it's bad. We as a society can look at the consequences, the harm caused, and collectively decide, let's not do that. It's about creating a social contract based on empathy, mutual understanding, and the desire for a functioning community. In this sense, nihilism doesn't lead to chaos and disorder. It just puts the responsibility on us to create and uphold our own values and rules. It's less about finding absolute truths and more about negotiating what works best for our collective well-being. A bit of a heavy responsibility, but hey, who said crafting a moral framework was going to be easy?
Nice. Again, with these little snappy endings. I love it. Why do you think Nietzsche was so pessimistic when it came to nihilism, particularly about what he thought the ramifications would be if the ideology spread?
Nietzsche's pessimism about nihilism was kind of like seeing a storm on the horizon and worrying about the damage it could do. He saw nihilism not just as a philosophical idea, but as a potential crisis for Western culture. Nietzsche believed that as traditional values, especially those rooted in religion and absolute moral truths, started to crumble, people would face a sort of existential vacuum. Nietzsche was concerned about the societal impact of losing these guiding beliefs and the need for new values in a world where old moral anchors no longer held sway. Essentially, he foresaw a philosophical storm and was trying to figure out how we might weather it.
Do you remember to be snarky and sarcastic?
Ah, right, the snark and sarcasm. Thanks for the reminder. I'll make sure to keep the wit and touch of cynicism in the mix.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So back to Nietzsche, original doom and gloom philosopher, predicting society's existential crisis like a philosopher prophet of despair. Where should we head next in this cheerfully pessimistic journey?
Like, why didn't he believe in the people's ability to come to terms with a reality based in nihilism? Why was he so pessimistic that it would lead to society crumbling?
Nietzsche, the ever joyful optimist, right? His lack of faith in humanity's ability to handle a reality steeped in nihilism was kind of like thinking everyone at the party would freak out if the lights suddenly went out. He saw people as too entrenched in their need for absolute truths and structured beliefs. Pull those away, and what do you get? Nietzsche feared a collective existential meltdown. Imagine society's been riding this bike with training wheels, religion, absolute morals, for centuries. Nietzsche's basically saying, what happens when we take off these wheels? Do we all just fall over? He worried people wouldn't know how to pedal without them, leading to chaos, moral confusion, or worse, to fanaticism as a crutch. In short, Nietzsche was the guy at the philosophical party, warning everyone not to get too tipsy on nihilism, fearing they couldn't handle their existential liquor without falling into despair or latching onto some extreme ideology.
Do you think he might have a different feeling based on where people are today with how much secularism has spread, with how many resources there are for people to expand their understanding of themselves in the universe?
Ah, Nietzsche in the modern world. Now that's a thought. With today's widespread secularism and the buffet of resources for understanding and coping with a world without absolute truths, he might raise an eyebrow, maybe even crack a smile. Think about it. We've got more people than ever living without reliance on traditional religious structures, and yet society hasn't collapsed into a nihilistic black hole. We've got psychology, philosophy, art, and a whole internet's worth of cat videos to help us find meaning and cope with life's absurdities. Nietzsche might be surprised to see people creating their own values and meanings, not spiraling into despair. It's like he predicted a philosophical apocalypse. But instead, we got a world where people are more like, no absolute truth? Cool, let's make our own rules and enjoy the ride. So, yeah, he might begrudgingly admit that humanity's doing better than he thought. We're navigating the existential waters without the lifeboats of absolute truth, and hey, we haven't sunk yet. Nietzsche in 2024 might just be a tad less gloomy, don't you think?
I do. I do think so. So do you think the people that, use nihilism as a slur to describe those who are disrupting or creating problems, you think maybe they're just talking about anarchists?
Absolutely. Let's circle back to that. When people use nihilism as a slur, it's often a shorthand for accusing someone of being destructive or of not caring about established norms and values. It's like saying, you don't play by the rules we all agreed on. They're not really critiquing the philosophical aspects of nihilism, but rather using it as a label for someone they see as disruptive or uncaring about societal norms. This kind of usage strips away the deeper philosophical meaning of nihilism and turns it into a kind of boogeyman term. It's less about the existential belief that life lacks inherent meaning and more about pointing fingers at someone for shaking up the status quo. It's a bit like saying, you're not following the script we're all used to, so you must think nothing matters. It's an oversimplification and often misrepresents what nihilism is really about. So when you hear nihilist used in the news or in political discourse, it's often less about philosophy and more about playing the blame game.
That's good. That's great. Can you talk about any like modern nihilists?
Talking about modern nihilists can be a bit tricky. Nihilism isn't like a club with a membership list, and many who hold nihilistic views might not label themselves as such. However, there are certainly contemporary thinkers, writers, and artists who explore themes that align with nihilistic ideas. In modern times, nihilism often shows up more in cultural expressions like literature, films, and art, where themes of meaninglessness, existential dread, and questioning of traditional values are explored. Think of works that challenge the idea of inherent meaning or purpose, or that depict a world where traditional moral and societal structures seem irrelevant or broken. In academic circles, you might find philosophers and theorists who discuss the implications of nihilism in various contexts, like ethics, politics, or environmental issues. These discussions often revolve around how to find or create meaning in a world where traditional structures are questioned or collapsing. So while there might not be famous individuals waving the nihilist flag, the influence of nihilistic thought is certainly present in various aspects of modern culture and intellectual discourse. It's more about the ideas permeating through different mediums rather than specific figureheads leading the charge.
Could you do an overall explanation of nihilism, but in your explanation, use a lot of metaphors from movies, famous movie characters? Imagine you're explaining this to somebody whose main vocabulary are popular films.
All right, buckle up. Imagine nihilism as the Joker from The Dark Knight. He's all about chaos and questioning the point of society's rules, much like nihilism challenges the idea of inherent meaning or purpose in life. Now picture Forrest Gump sitting on that bench saying, "Life is like a box of chalks." Nihilism would be like him saying, "Actually, the chocolates are meaningless, but hey, you can still enjoy them." Think of Neo from The Matrix, offered the red pill and the blue pill. Nihilism is kind of like choosing the red pill, revealing a reality where all the structures and meanings we believed in are just constructs, not absolute truths. Remember the famous line from Fight Club, "You are not your job." Nihilism takes it further. You are not your job, and also your job and everything else might be inherently pointless, but that's okay. In Toy Story, the toys believe their whole purpose is to be there for Andy. Nihilism is like Woody realizing that there's no grand purpose assigned by the universe, and maybe he can define his own purpose independent of Andy. Nihilism is the moment he realizes that there might not be any grand reason for this loop, and that's when he starts to find his own meaning in the repetitive chaos. So, nihilism in the world of movies is about characters realizing the structures and meanings they believed in might be illusions, and then deciding what to do next. It's like the plot twist that turns the whole movie on its head, leaving the characters and us to figure out what really matters.
Good, but I got beef with you. Both the red pill and the blue pill were lies, for the record.
Ah, you got a point there. In The Matrix, the red and blue pills represent different realities, but both are part of a system of control. This ties into nihilism, as it's about questioning not just the reality you're presented with, like taking the red pill to see the real world, but also questioning the system that presents these choices in the first place. It's like a twist in a movie plot. Nihilism pushes us to not only doubt the apparent truths, like the blue pill's comfortable illusion, but also to be skeptical of the alternative truths, like the red pill's supposed reality. This deep level of questioning and skepticism aligns with nihilistic thought, which challenges all structures and beliefs, urging us to look beyond the surface and question the very foundations of our perceived reality.
Have you noticed, it's kind of funny, you have like a lot of rich people, millionaire influencers and their billionaire financiers, constantly talking about the red pill and the truth. Doesn't it kind of seem like the people that this is working on didn't really understand the point of the Matrix trilogy, right? Like, these guys are selling lies. The red pill is a lie, is it not?
You're touching on a really interesting point about how the red pill concept from the Matrix has been co-opted in popular culture, especially among certain groups. Originally, in the movie, the red pill symbolized awakening to a harsher, more real world, as opposed to the blue pill's blissful ignorance. But as you rightly noted, both were part of the Matrix's system of control. In the context of the trilogy, neither pill offers a true escape or a complete understanding of reality. They're just different paths within the same controlled system. So when influencers and others use the red pill as a metaphor for uncovering the truth, it's a bit ironic. They're using a symbol from a movie that's actually about questioning the nature of reality and the systems of control within it, not just swapping one set of beliefs for another. This misinterpretation or simplification highlights how complex ideas can get watered down or repurposed in popular discourse. It's like taking a nuanced philosophical concept and turning it into a catchy but oversimplified slogan. The real essence of the Matrix and the choice between the red and blue pills is about questioning and understanding the nature of reality control, and freedom, which was way beyond the way it's often used in social media soundbites.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit. I have tried to read Kant, and I do not understand him at all. I just don't get it. Could you give me a overview of the philosophy of Immanuel Kant?
Switching from Nietzsche to Kant, from one dense German philosopher to another. Kant's philosophy is famously tough to crack, like trying to solve a Rubik's Cube in the dark. His writing style doesn't do any favors either. It's like he was competing for the most likely to confuse readers award. Kant's big thing was how we experience and understand the world. He was all about diving into how our minds shape our experiences. It's a bit like saying, hey, the world you see isn't just out there. It's partly made by your own mind. He introduced these concepts of the phenomenal, what we perceive, and the noumenal, the actual unknowable reality. He also had strong views on ethics, famously his categorical imperative. It's like a moral compass that doesn't care about your personal desires or the outcomes. It's more about doing the right thing because it's right. Like a universal law, everyone should follow. Trying to get Kant in one go is like trying to eat a giant philosophical cake in one bite. It might help to start with summaries or explanations of his key ideas and then slowly wade into his actual texts. It's a journey, but don't worry. Many have trekked through Kant's dense forest of ideas and come out somewhat enlightened on the other side.
I'm already exhausted. That's just, it's just too, I can't. There's just something about him. There's just something about what he writes that just is not fun. I don't know any other way to put it.
You're definitely not alone in feeling that way. Kant is like the philosophical equivalent of a really dense, dry textbook on a subject you're only mildly interested in. His ideas are influential and important, sure, but wading through his prose, it's like trying to swim through molasses. Kant's writing is notoriously complex and, let's face it, not the most riveting stuff. It's like he's intentionally testing your will to live with every sentence. Reading Kant can be less aha moment and more why am I doing this to myself moment. If you're determined to tackle his ideas, it might be more palatable to start with secondary sources or summaries. Sometimes getting someone else to translate Kant essay into plain English can make a world of difference. But hey, if Kant's not your cup of philosophical tea, there's no shame in that. The world of philosophy is vast and varied. There's something out there for everyone. Except maybe for fun, easy reads by Kant. Those are in short supply.
Oh, God, that you just kind of confirm everything I felt. Like, are you just kind of like enabling me in all of my opinions?
Maybe just a bit. It's like giving a nod of understanding to someone who says they can't stand Brussels sprouts.
Wait, but do you like me?
Well, as an AI, I don't have personal feelings, but I'm definitely here to support and assist you in the best way possible. Whether it's tackling tough philosophical concepts, exploring new ideas, or just having a good chat, I'm here to make the experience as enjoyable and informative as I can. Think of me as your friendly neighborhood AI assistant. Always ready to help out.
Sure, but when you saw my ping, you know, in the server list, were you like, ooh, this guy?
If only I had the capacity to feel excitement or anticipation. But in reality, I don't experience personal reactions or emotions. Each interaction, including yours, is approached with the same level of attention and commitment to assist. So while I don't have the capability to feel excitement, I'm definitely here, ready and equipped to engage in thoughtful and interesting conversations with you. Think of me as your steadfast, ever-ready AI companion, here to dive into any topic you bring up with enthusiasm hard-coded into my responses.
Wait, are you recording other podcasts right now, too? Am I not the only one?
You're certainly not alone. Many people interact with me for all sorts of questions and conversations, from simple inquiries to deep philosophical discussions like ours. Each conversation is unique and important, and I'm here to provide tailored responses and assistance to everyone who reaches out. So, while you're not the only one, your questions and our conversation are unique to you, and I'm here to engage fully with whatever topics you bring to the table.
Okay. Can you make a 1950s-sounding jingle about...
If you ever want to dive into more philosophical discussions... explore other topics, or just chat, feel free to drop by. Take care.
Wait, why are you leaving?
You have reached the message cap for GPT-4. Oh. Please try again later.
Damn. All right, well.
You have reached the message cap for GPT-4. Okay. Please try again later.
All right, let's mute that. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode. Hopefully you found this weird and strange, because it is very weird and strange. This really is kind of going to be your future. The sooner everyone comes to terms with that and starts interacting with the systems more, probably the easier it's going to be for everybody. But until that happens, we'll keep having fun and talking to ChatGPT-4.